Boy, there sure is a lot of people out there tonight. Man, whoa. My name is Forrest, and I am an alcoholic. First thing I'd like to say is thanks for having me here tonight. Thanks, Angel, for asking me. It's always a real privilege to get to speak at an AA meeting. AA has saved my life, literally. I am quite sure that I would be dead by now if I had not found Alcoholics Anonymous. For too many times, I have been to a speaker meeting and heard a real long, drawn-out drunkalogue. So I try to put my talk in the context of the 12 steps, because that's where our solution lies. It's in the steps. It's in working with one another and helping one another get through these steps. So I'm going to try to share what little bit I know about getting sober, about being happy, and living a productive life. I hope some of you get something out of this. I have been told many times in my life that we're all dual addicted. We all have multiple addictions, and one addiction exacerbates another. Well, my two addictions have been alcohol and divorce court. So as soon as I put the alcohol aside, the divorce court thing kind of went away all by itself, you know. So I think it is true that we are dual addicted. Again, I want to emphasize that there's nothing unique about me. There's nothing unique about my story. When I got here, I thought I was unique. I thought nobody had the problems that I have, and nobody has ever been as bad a drunk or as bad a person as I am. And I'm happy to tell y'all that is absolutely not true. I'm a run-of-the-mill alcoholic. I'm a run-of-the-mill human being. And there's no way I can tell you how grateful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a really hard time getting sober. I came in here, 26, 27 years ago. And over the first 8 years or so I was in, I picked up four white chips because, for a lot of reasons, I could give you a list of reasons, anxiety, panic attacks, PTSD, etc., etc. But I was always kind of holding alcohol as an ace in the hole. If this happens, I'm going to drink. If my anxiety gets too bad, I'm going to drink. If one more woman dumps my ass, I am going to drink, you know. So I always had something that was going to allow me to drink. And as long as I had that something, that ace in the hole, I kept going back out. So over that eight-year period, I picked up four white chips. I picked up my last white chip January 28th, 2003. And it was, I got some instructions with that. They told me to put it in my mouth, and when it melted, I could have a drink. So that one worked. Let's see. I'm going to read a couple of things. These are not from AA literature, but I started off by saying I thought my life was especially difficult. I had a little trip to Ridgeview as part of my getting sober attempt, and I'll tell that story in a few minutes. But while I was there, somebody gave me a book by Scott Peck called The Road Less Traveled. The very first paragraph in that book told me that the man had understood me and that he had a solution for my problem. And here's how that first paragraph goes. Life is difficult. That's the whole paragraph. This is a great truth, one of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly know and understand it, then life is no longer difficult, because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters. My big book says the same thing. It says acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And that is very, very true. That's been said a million different ways by all sorts of religious figures, philosophers, psychologists, whatever. But as soon as I stop fighting reality and accept reality, I have a chance of changing my situation. As long as I fight reality, I am going to suffer. My life is going to get progressively worse. So I love that paragraph, and one that goes along with it is at the very end of Appendix 2 in our big book, and it says, there is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. I was working with a new sponsee the other night, and something was said that I've heard many times in AA, and I think it's really important. Nobody is too stupid to get this program, but many of us are too smart. We are too smart because we think we know everything and we're not willing to listen. And I was one of those people. I had to learn how to listen right here in this room and other rooms just like it. So everyone is something else I want to touch on. I don't think we alcoholics are different than other people, except for the fact that we need alcohol. I think every human being has this disease called more. I want more of everything. I want faster cars, bigger houses, more money, hotter women. You know, I want it all. We all have this disease called more. Alcoholics are fortunate enough to have a bad enough case of more that we've got to do something about it or die. So we come in here and we find out how to live. We come in here looking for something to solve our alcohol problem. Instead, we find a way to live and a way to be productive and a way to be happy. And that way to live begins with the 12 steps. So step one tells me I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. I've always been an alcoholic. Some people had to work at it. I did not have to work at it. The first time I tasted alcohol, I was an alcoholic. Now, I grew up in a very poor rural part of Georgia. I'm sure you've all heard of Devil's Pond, Georgia. That's where I'm from. There is nothing there, believe me. There is nothing there. But at the time I grew up, it was a moonshining center for this state. There was moonshine everywhere. I was hauling moonshine by the time I was 15 years old. So when I was real little, doctors were hard to come by. And if you got sick, it didn't matter what was the matter with you. They gave you a teaspoon of sugar soaked in moonshine, and that was your medicine. You were either going to get well or die. That was the way it was. So I got sick a lot. On purpose, you know. Teething pains, cough, fever, whatever. That's what they gave you. It was a spoonful of sugar soaked in moonshine, and there you go. Very few times did we actually go to a doctor. But my first real drug took place when I was 5 years old. I had a cousin who used to be on the Grand Ole Opry, and he and some of my other cousins were all musicians, and they came down to our house in Oglethorpe County, and they brought some cases of Carling Black Label beer. I don't know if any of y'all remember Carling Black Label beer, but it is bad. It is bad, bad stuff. Here I am, this little kid. They're running around. They're playing their instruments. They're singing all these Hank Williams songs, which were brand new at the time. That'll tell you how old I am. This was the early 50s. And they kept saying, I can't finish this beer. Would you finish this beer for me? And they got me knee-walking, pie-eyed drunk. Now, I had some aunts. One was good buddies with Oral Roberts and his son, Anal. And I go walking. Here I am, this five-year-old kid, and these aunts are sitting at the dining room table. And I go walking in, and I distinctly remember as I'm walking into the room tilting until I fell right over in the floor. My dad picked me up, put me to bed, and just raised hell with my cousins. But I loved it. I loved that whole experience. And from that time onward in my life, I drank as much as I could every chance I got. Just loved it, you know. Some people have excuses for drinking. They'd say, oh, I like the taste of wine, so I have some, you know, good bottle of wine, whatever. The only reason anybody drinks alcohol, I don't care what they say, is to change the way they feel. If I feel bad, if I have a drink, I'm going to feel better. If I feel real good, if I have a drink, I'm going to feel even better. So that's why we drink. We want to change the way we feel. The process of getting sober is learning to deal with how I feel in a realistic way without any chemical assistance. That's what I learned in here. So I'm going to tell a couple of stories about my drinking and how I got here. My one and only trip to Ridgeview was thanks to my last evil ex-wife, who I had taken quite a few Xanax and a bottle of scotch, and things got kind of out of control, so she called the police. So the police are all here at my house. There's police cars, fire trucks, a couple of ambulances. I mean, this was a real scene, you know. The last thing I remember is that four cops coming at me from four directions, and this evil woman said, "Be careful, he's a martial arts expert." Now, folks, I don't know a damn thing about my martial arts. This woman wanted to see these cops kick my butt, and they did they all pulled out those nightsticks. That's back when they carried the real clubs. I don't remember a thing after that until I woke up at Northside Hospital. From there, I went to Georgia Regional Hospital, which is a nightmare. In fact, if anybody could ever avoid going to Georgia Regional, I really recommend avoiding Georgia Regional. But I did end up at Ridgeview, and Ridgeview was a good experience for me. They put me in there, they locked the door, and I knew I wasn't going to get out, and I knew I had a problem. And I thought, well, I'm here, it's going to cost me a lot of money, and I'm not getting out for 30 days no matter what I do, so I'm going to get everything out of this that I can get out of it. So I took it very seriously, and I started to get sober. That was in 1988. Unfortunately, I did not stay sober after that little experience. One more story I want to tell y'all, so you get a good idea of the depth of my thinking over the years. In 1965, I was getting ready to graduate from high school, and I had this real serious problem that I'd been working on for a long time, and that was a virginity problem. I wanted somebody to help me out with this virginity problem, and I could not find a cooperative person to do that, you know. So I didn't know it then, but sex wasn't invented until 1965. But anyhow, these two Marine Corps recruiters came to our high school, and they came marching down into the cafeteria, marching this way, and they turned, they marched down that way, and they're in dress blues. And those guys looked so sharp. It was incredible just how sharp those guys looked. And my little 18-year-old mind thought, man, if I had one of those uniforms, I bet I could get laid every day. Where do I sign up? So I went in the Marine Corps. I would like to say it was patriotism, or because I thought it would be a good future or something, but that would be untrue. Okay. A few weeks later, I'm down at Parris Island trying to avoid drill instructor Sergeant Hughes because he liked to beat recruits, and fighting off the heat, Sergeant Hughes and sand fleas wondering where all the girls were, and they just weren't around, you know. So that was my level of thinking about anything. I was just extremely impulsive. If a thought came to my mind and it seemed like a good idea, I put no thought into it whatsoever. Where do I sign up? What do I do? You know? So that's how I came to be in the Marine Corps. 1967, I got sent to Vietnam. I was in the 1st Marine Air Wing, and 20 years old when I got there. And we got hit a lot. We had a lot of rocket attacks, mortar attacks, etc. We got hit with ground forces three times. And Vietnam was an interesting experience. I made a lot of very good friends there. I don't think I have been closer in my life than I was to the guys that I was in Vietnam with. We supported each other. We listened to each other's bullshit. We tried to save each other's lives. We were a very close-knit group of people. But when we came back, it was a mess. We were a mess. We were not welcomed back like young people are today when they go off. We were pretty much scorned. My own family acted like I'd been away at a vacation or something somewhere. They didn't, I'm sure it wasn't intended this way, but they just didn't say too much about Vietnam. And I carried that around with me for a really long time, you know. After Vietnam, I started looking for God. I had a five-year-old son. I wanted him to be raised with some sort of spiritual life, some values and whatever that I felt I was lacking in my life. So I went through the whole gamut of churches. I studied the Bible. I studied religion. I did this, that, and the other thing. I ended up joining the Mormon church. I was a Mormon for about 2 years. I joined the church. I used to get baptized a lot, but they never held me under that water long enough to stop me from drinking. I think it would have taken about 20 minutes or so, and it was just in and out, you know. So anyway, I joined the Mormon church. I was ordained, and then I was excommunicated. So that was my my experience with religion. The reason I was excommunicated is a belief that I have to this very day. God is huge. God is much bigger than any one religion. I don't care if it's Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Jew, whatever. God is bigger than any of these prepackaged religions. And I have an issue with people that say, my way is the only way. So they kicked me out, you know, and I'm glad. I preached one Sunday to about 250 people. I said pretty much what I just said. And the next thing I know, I'm in the bishop's office. The next thing I'm getting my letter from the church saying, don't come back. Okay, so that was my experience with church. After that, I attended some other churches, but I really found the spirituality I was looking for in Buddhism. In 68, I went on R&R to Malaysia, and I visited a Buddhist temple, and those monks had something that I wanted. They had a peace. They had a way of being in the world that was just serving other people. That's what they were all about, and I wanted that. I wanted that for myself, and unfortunately, I didn't stop drinking or pursue Buddhism, but it interested me, and later on, it came to be something very important to me. Anyway, the other thing that happened in Vietnam, and this is a little funny, Mike and I went on R&R, that was my buddy. Buddy and I know too many Mikes. I see Mike sitting back there now. I went to a meeting with Thursday night and a couple other Mikes around. Mike and I went to the China Beach R&R Center for a three-day in-country R&R. There we were captured by the Seabees trying to get to a cat house. And I don't know anybody else in the world that's had that experience, you know. We were sneaking under the wire at midnight or so, trying to make our way to these houses, and all of a sudden flares went off. Boom, 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 boom. And it was like daylight out here. Mike drops to his knees and starts digging a hole in the sand because I know they're going to cut loose with his machine guns and tear his machine gun towers. And in a minute, I hear rifle bolts all over the place, and I stood up and said, don't shoot, God damn it, we're just out here trying to get, you know. So anyway, that was my second R&R in Vietnam, was getting captured by the Seabees. I thought that was a funny story, but nobody laughed, so guess not. Anyhow, this business of looking for God, I've said in meetings a lot of times, and I really believe that this is true, that a man looking for God is like a fish swimming along in the ocean looking for the water. You know, the only thing separating that fish from the water is his idea of what water is. The only thing that's separating us from God is our belief that God is some finite thing that we can grasp or understand and get hold of. Or really, all we need to do is stop and breathe and look at the beauty in nature and in one another, in the love that we have for one another and the love we have for our children, our pets. That's where God is, in this love and this caring that we have for one another. So looking for God is just a simple matter of relaxing and experiencing God. Our literature says God as we understood him. I haven't met anybody yet that understands God, not one person. I don't think there's enough neurons between these ears to do that, or any of yours either. So just relax. Just relax and enjoy life. Enjoy nature. Enjoy one another. That's where this whole experience of God is the power. We talk in step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. That power lies in the action of working these steps. I spent a lot of time during that first 8 years studying, trying to understand God, trying to find the right church, the right combination of things to do. It's not understanding. We don't work these steps with the intellect. We work them with our heart. When they genuinely work, we work them with our heart, not with our mind. So when I pick up a pen and I start writing, I'm finished with step three. Okay? When I understand that the power to get me sober lies in these steps, I'm finished with step two. When I got to step three, surrender. Boy, I didn't like that word. That's hard for a Marine when you say surrender. It's like, no, we're not going to do that, you know. What a horrible word that is. And surrender my will and my life over to something I cannot see, that I have no hope of fully understanding, and giving up myself. No, thank you. I was not going to do that. And I think the wording of step three is unfortunate, because when we read that, that's the impression that it gives, that I'm going to totally turn my will and my life over to God or some higher power. And I was not prepared to do that. And I don't think I was capable of doing that when I worked step three or when I started trying to get sober. But I went ahead and started doing the steps. When I finally got sober, I did this thing called surrender, finally, for the first time in my life. I had been at home for about 6 weeks drunk. My plan was, I'm going to get sober January the 1st. That's going to be my sobriety date, January the 1st. Couldn't do it. I was so sick that I had to have a drink. So I drank January 1st. Set a new date, January 5th. That's my belly button birthday. I'll stop then. By January 5th, I could not stop either. I was just too sick. I was trying to detox at home. I really don't recommend that if you're as sick as I was at that time. Get some help. But anyway, it took me till January 28th. And on January 28th, I went out into my front yard and I earnestly prayed and I earnestly surrendered for the first time in my life. What I said was, I am empty. I have used up everything I have. I am empty. I don't know what to do. I don't know which way to turn. So you do with me whatever you want to do with me. Just please help me get sober. And I haven't had a drink since then. And I believe that that total, complete surrender is the key to getting sober, to starting a new life. It's knowing I don't have any more answers, I don't have anywhere else to go, and being totally and completely willing to work this program. So, let's see. And that's all I got to say about that. Step four and five are really interesting also. In order for me to be comfortable and happy in this world, I've got to clean up my mess. And step four is where, I've heard it said, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where I start cleaning up the things in my life that keep me awake at night, that keep me from going to the mailbox because it's full of bills, or keep me scared, keep me anxious, all of that. I start doing an inventory of those things. And George Walsh, I was hoping Cameron would be here tonight. George Walsh was my sponsor at that time. And Cameron is a granddaughter. And I think it's a real cool thing that today my early sponsor's granddaughter is one of my closest friends. I am just real happy about that. So anyway, George tells me I got to do this inventory, and I said, George, I can't do that. Why not? Well, somebody is going to find it, and they're going to publish in the Atlanta Constitution for sure, and I know I'm going to go to jail. And I was just like Charlie Baines. I thought everything was all about me. Now, Charlie one time said he went to a football game. Those guys got in a huddle, And he just knew they were talking about him. Well, that was me, you know. It was all about me. And I was afraid to write that stuff down. So I got on my computer. I did my fourth step on my computer, passworded the document, passworded my computer, and I could never get back into the damn thing again. It is still floating around out there somewhere on a hard drive and a heart in a trash heap, and I hope it stays buried for at least the next 100 years or so. But then I picked up a pen and paper, and I did my fourth step exactly the way it's described in the big book. I got all done with it, and just writing it out was tremendously helpful to me. But then George says, now you've got to share it with somebody. And I said, no. Writing it down was bad enough. I am not sharing this with anybody. So George and I went back and forth on that for a little bit. And finally he said, all right, I'll set you up with a priest in Conyers at the monastery. So he did. Here is the way that went. George set me up with Father Damien to do my fifth step. Father Damien had taken a vow of silence. He was locked up in a monastery. He was 80 years old and going to die soon. So I figured, okay, that's good. I can do that. You know, he won't live long enough to share this with anybody. So I went down, I did my fifth step, and I want to tell y'all, that was the most freeing thing I think I've ever done. When I got that fifth step done, I walked out of that monastery about 3 feet off the ground. That's the first time in my life that I had felt honestly and completely free. And the other thing about it is I thought I was going to shock that old man into a heart attack. But Father Damien had been a merchant marine until he was 40 years old. Then he became a monk. And I hadn't done nothing that old man hadn't done, not one thing. And when you do your fifth step here in these rooms, you're going to find the same thing. We all have done the same stuff. It's all about romance or finance, one or the other. Those are the two things that get us in trouble, romance and finance. So don't be ashamed. Don't be worried. Don't be scared. Doing step 4 and 5 is a joyous thing. It's a freeing thing. It's a gift. So do it. Don't be afraid of it, you know. And then we get to the other steps. Steps 6, 7, 8, and 9. Now, step 6 in the big book, there's one paragraph dedicated to that step, and I think 2, maybe 3 to step 7. That's not enough. Not enough at all. The 12 and 12 talks extensively about step 6 and 7. And to make a list of all my character defects, I should, if I had done step 5 correctly with a sponsor, by the time I finish that, I have a list of my character defects. I know what my habituated behaviors are that have caused me so much trouble. And I can humbly ask God to remove those all I want to. And that just shows a willingness to do that. Actually getting rid of those character defects takes work. Now, I know there are people in here that disagree with that. It's like, no, I asked God and they were gone. Good for you. Good for you. But that is not my experience, and it's not the experience of anyone I have ever worked with. We have to be very mindful of them. Let's say one of my character defects is lying. I have to watch myself. If somebody asks me a question, my first impulse is to lie. So I pause. Think about what I'm about to say. And then very consciously tell the truth. I habituate a new behavior, you know. Or I say the Serenity Prayer, or I say some other prayer before I answer these people. But it's changing the way I think. And changing the way I think is what this whole deal is about. Then there's steps 8 and 9. Made a list of all persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Well, amends are something that we need to talk very carefully with our sponsor over. You do not want to go to your neighbor and say, oh, I am so sorry, but I've been sleeping with your wife for the last 6 years, and I hope you can forgive me, you know. You don't want to do that. It might get you hurt, might get him divorced, might cost his kids their home. All kinds of consequences can come out of just recklessly going out here and shooting your mouth off. So be careful with your amends. Talk them over with your sponsor, but do them. But I want to tell y'all, I told you I had a five-year-old son when I got back from Vietnam. I was crazy when I got back from Vietnam, and I was drunk, and I was abusive, and I was mean to that kid. It was terrible. One of the best days of my life, and I hope I don't cry, my son came to me and told me that he forgave me for all the crap I put him through when he was growing up. That was a pivotal day for me. He and I spent the entire day talking about individual things that happened as he was growing up, and I took my part. I took my part. I said I was sorry, and he and I we don't have as close a relationship as I would like, but there's no animosity between my son and I anymore, and there certainly was for a long time. The other amends that was very hard for me was my own father. My father died in 1976, and I used hating him as an excuse to drink until 2003. You know, if you'd had my upbringing, you would drink too. If it wasn't for him, I would be 4 inches taller and rich and all this other stuff, you know. So I had a real hard time with my relationship with my father. The way I did that one, that is forgiveness. And forgiveness is a very important part of this this step work as well. It's not just what they did, but it is forgiving people and forgiving ourselves. I took a lawn chair down to the cemetery where my parents are buried. I spent the entire day sitting down there in that lawn chair, talking to my parents, praying, forgiving my father for all the abuse that he had put me through. I did that after my son forgave me, because if my son could do it for me, I could certainly do it for my dad. And that hatred that I had for that man ate me alive. Hatred kills you. This bitterness, this anger, these resentments, that stuff kills you. It just poisons everything that you do in this life. So do whatever you've got to do to forgive people, to be forgiven by people, whatever. But these steps give us a process for doing that. And get help. Get help from a sponsor. There's no way to overemphasize the importance of a sponsor. Let's see. Continue to take personal inventory. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Years ago, if I was arguing with you, and I love to argue, man, I just fed my ego like you would not believe. Argue, argue, argue. We'd reach a point in this argument where I knew I was wrong. So I just got louder. You know, if I can't be right, I can at least shout you down, you know. And that, I used to think that makes me look smart or powerful. And all it really does is make me look stupid and arrogant. What makes a person look smart is the ability to say, you know what, I'm wrong. I was wrong about that. I need to change my mind. I need some new information. I need to change the way I'm thinking. So today, it doesn't bother me to say I'm wrong. It's very easy to say I'm wrong today because I have said it so many times, and all you married guys will relate to this. I have said it so many times, I'm used to it. It doesn't hurt to say I'm wrong, not at all. Not nearly as much as knowing you're wrong and walking away with that on your conscience, you know. Step 11 is the most important step for me today. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. I could talk all day long about meditation. I took my first formal meditation training in 1971. And have been through training quite a bit since then. And today we have a little group, most of which is what is sitting here tonight. We get together on Sundays and we meditate. And we talk to one another about our meditation practice. And it is so significant. It is so meaningful. I had written this down, but the process of examining our own thoughts in order to understand why we do what we do is a part of the meditation process. The 12 and 12 says, and I did not write it down, I can't quote it, meditation, prayer, and self-examination are all essential things. All these things linked together. And to try and learn to do that alone or to try to practice that alone is not something I really recommend, not at all. There are all kind of places around Atlanta that you can get some formal meditation training. Meditating with a group of people is extremely powerful, much more powerful than sitting by yourself for a whole lot of different reasons. But learn to meditate. I get up every morning and meditate. My friend Julie back there gets up every morning and meditates for 40 minutes. She'll tell you all about it. And she's fairly new at it, you know. So I'm impressed with her rigor. I really am. Like I said, I was introduced to Buddhism in Malaysia in 1968. John, who's sitting back there right now, was a sponsor for a while. And his sponsor was Buddhist. And we went to his house. He gave me a book called Awakening the Buddha Within, which has become a key part of my life. We all have this connection with God, with higher power within us. Bill tells us that in the big book, both in Appendix 2 and on page 55. And we just need to learn how to reach that, how to touch that. And you can call it soul, you can call it Buddha nature, you can call it whatever you want to. But it's something that every human being has the capacity to do. And it will change your life. It'll totally change your life. Sometimes people ask me if I'm a Christian, or they ask me if I'm a this or that. Usually I say I'm a Buddhist. But what I really practice is kind of an eclectic blend of Christianity and Buddhism and Hinduism. Find what works for you. You know, find what works for you and do that. I've seen so many people fail in this program because they try to make somebody else's conception of a higher power their conception rather than finding their own. Find your own. Make this program your own. Make it yours. Not your sponsors, not mine, not somebody else. Make it yours. Figure out how to integrate it into your innermost thinking. Step 11 is the key to that, in my opinion. Then step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. I want to go a little bit philosophical here, but I really believe this is true. The goal of every human being is to be happy. Think about that. What do you really want out of life? We all want to be happy. But we never stop very much to think about what happiness really means. We confuse happiness with pleasure. Give me enough pleasure and I'll be happy. That's not true. Pleasure ends and leaves you wanting more pleasure, leaves you chasing more pleasure. Happiness consists of four things. It is equanimity. And all four of these things are contained in our program, and especially in step 12. Equanimity, inner peace. I get that inner peace from working steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 because I've squared away myself and I've squared away all of my relationships with other people. So now I don't have anything to be anxious about. I don't have anything to worry about, you know. So inner peace is one. We find that through the steps. The second, the formal name for that is altruistic love. And I think that altruistic love is one reason that this program works, is the love that we have for one another. To me, working with a sponsee, helping them get this program, helping them find a path to some real happiness is the greatest kind of love that I can show anybody in this world. So that's altruistic love. The second is active compassion. It's not just feeling sorry for somebody, it's doing something. And it's the same thing. When I'm working with a sponsee, I'm doing it out of love and I'm doing it out of compassion for that person. I'm not doing it for myself, I'm doing it for their sake. Having joy in other people, we call it sympathetic joy. joy in seeing other people succeed. What is that? Well, how do you feel when you got a sponsee and all of a sudden that light goes on in their eyes and you know they got it, you know they're going to stay sober? That is a joyous moment. That is the best kind of joy. Inner peace, that's it. Those are the four ingredients. Those are the things that we do to make us happy, and all of those are contained right there in step 12. When we do 12-step work, we get to experience true happiness for ourselves and for other people. Let's see, and I'm going to close with this. This is from page 164 of the Big Book. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless and keep you until then. What greater happiness can be had than what's right there in that paragraph? That's it, you know. So, thank you all. Good night.